Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Chronic Fatigue and Burnout Recovery Podcast. Today, I wanted to talk about low mood, essentially depression or just generally feeling a little bit low, seasonal affective disorder, and PMDD, which is premenstrual dysphoric disorder. Although I won't necessarily be covering each of these, for example, the seasonal affective disorder or SAD or the PMDD in a lot of detail, I've kind of put them all in this bigger category of low mood or depression because that's essentially how they are presenting in the body. And this was actually a listener request. So it was someone asking for support about SAD specifically, SAD specifically. But I thought it would be much easier to do a bigger umbrella and cover the bases of all of these different ways in which low mood presents, more generally speaking, as opposed to focusing in on one, although I may focus in on some of these in future episodes, specifically the PMDD, I think would be quite interesting to cover. So one of the things I'll say up front is a lot of the mechanisms that contribute to low energy are also mechanisms that contribute to low mood. So if you're somebody who's experiencing low mood alongside your chronic health condition, whatever that might be, chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, an autoimmune condition, a post-viral fatigue, long COVID, something like that, my first encouragement is not to necessarily see your mood as separate from these conditions, something that's managed separately, but actually they're probably overlapping mechanisms which are contributing to both. And the low energy, which is experienced as fatigue, is probably also a factor in the low mood. And so as we work to improving energy, then we are also actually, in fact, working towards improving mood, which means that it might feel disappointing to hear upfront at the beginning of this episode that a lot of what I'm going to say, you've probably actually already heard me talk about on other episodes before. But it might be helpful to hear me talk about it in the context of mood specifically. And it's always helpful to hear me repeat things, or just it's always helpful to hear things repeated, not necessarily me repeat things, but it's always helpful to hear messages again and again and again, because sometimes we just hear the same thing presented in a different way and it lands a little bit differently. Or in the past where we heard something, we weren't really ready to accept it and take it on board, but then we hear that same information at a different place and a different time, and suddenly we feel more inspired. So as always, before we go into the full episode, just a reminder, if you haven't already, to leave a review on Spotify or iTunes. Your reviews just help improve the podcast ratings. It helps other people find the episodes and get the support that they need. And if you've already left a review, but you learned something today that you know could really help someone you know, please share the podcast with them. Or if you are active on social media channels, share it with your social media following. And I would just really appreciate that. Thank you so much. Let's talk about low mood, seasonal affective disorder, and PMDD. So just to kind of set the stage, mood disorders refer to significant changes in mood that have a negative impact on daily life. And it goes without saying, perhaps, that when someone experiences a chronic illness like chronic fatigue syndrome or some other energy limiting illness, they may feel low at times. I know I've felt desperately low at moments in my own fatigue recovery journey. However, this is different to someone who may be experiencing an ongoing low mood. So perhaps it's persistent. It's not just a day or two where you feel very low or in because you're in a crash, but it might be like an ongoing thing that's happening alongside the chronic fatigue. And it is perhaps, as I've already said, mechanistically, it's entangled with the mechanisms of the chronic fatigue, although we also see it as a separate thing. So in this particular podcast, I really want to discuss the different types of mood disorders and how we can approach supporting them alongside our overall journey of improving our health and energy in the context of experiencing an energy-limiting illness. So let's start by talking about some of the types of depression. Depression is a mood disorder characterized by persistent feelings of sadness, hopelessness, and lack of interest or pleasure in daily activities. And here I kind of just wanted to stretch out that distinction between feeling low at times, because I know, as I said already in my journey, I felt very sad. I felt very hopeless, but there wasn't necessarily like a persistent lack of interest or pleasure in daily activities. There was definitely still that motivation there. Like I wanted to exercise. I wanted to do things. I wanted to work, but I just couldn't because of my energy. I hadn't lost interest in those things. Maybe, you know, for about a few hours if I was having a very low moment, but it wasn't a persistent loss of interest in things that brought me joy and pleasure. Depression can affect people's thoughts, their emotions, even physical well-being, if we're looking at it from a nervous system lens, that more kind of dorsal experience. And it can lead to changes in sleep, appetite, energy levels, and concentration. And it can interfere with daily functioning. Obviously, we have to pull that apart between having chronic fatigue can impact daily functioning, but it's important to distinguish between not being able to do things because we physically can't due to lack of energy or fear of post-exertional malaise, and not being able to do things just because we don't feel the motivation to do them. And it may often require different types of therapeutic interventions. So therapy can be really helpful. As you probably know, if you've been listening to this podcast, I'm a big fan of somatic experiencing to expand out of some of that dorsal patterning in the nervous system. Sometimes medications can be really helpful. Diet and lifestyle changes and supplements can also be helpful, which is what we'll focus on a little bit today. Well, a lot today. There are several types of depressive disorders. And so the first one I'd like to introduce to you is major depressive disorder. And symptoms here include low mood, low self-esteem, loss of interest in activities of daily life, and low energy for at least a 2-week period. It can also include significant weight loss or weight gain, slowing down of thoughts, and a reduction in physical movement, obviously to be separated from an intentional reduction of physical movement for pacing or to prevent post-exertional malaise, and recurrent thoughts of death or suicidal ideation, but without a specific plan for committing suicide. So the pathophysiology of major depressive disorder and a lot of these low mood disorders is impaired activation of the prefrontal cortex of the brain. Then we have minor depressive disorder. So minor depressive disorder is similar to major depressive disorder in terms of the criteria, but an individual with minor depressive disorder will meet some of the criteria, but not all of them. So they may have similar symptoms, but just less, they're less symptomatic as a whole. And again, the pathophysiology can be related to impaired activation of the prefrontal cortex. Then we have recurrent brief depression, abbreviated as RBD. And RBD is characterized by intermittent depressive episodes not related to the menstrual cycle in women. They usually occur for 5 to 7 days, 6 to 12 times a year. And although brief, these episodes may be severe with suicidal ideation and impaired function. And the pathophysiology, again, may result from impaired activation of the prefrontal cortex and the limbic networks within the brain. And here, often RBD or the recurrent brief depressive episodes can be a clue to what might be going on with this individual. I've talked on the podcast previously about neuroinflammation, brain inflammation, and the concept of glial cell priming. So what that essentially means is when there has been a permanent change in the brain's immune system, and then due to that permanent change in the brain's immune system, it can be the inflammation of the brain can be triggered and reactivated by specific events. So for example, if somebody got a stomach bug or they had food poisoning, that could be a trigger for an increase in neuroinflammation. And so in the case of someone with RBD, maybe after the food poisoning incident, they could potentially feel more depressed for a little while as that brain inflammation is settling down. But that could interact with many other things. So for example, then if someone has Hashimoto's and glial cell priming, if they have a Hashimoto's flare, then a surge in thyroid hormones or something like that, that could also be another cause for a flare up. Or if they went on holiday and they ate some foods that they didn't normally eat, or they're going through a period of stress, all of these things could amplify the dial of neuroinflammation in the brain and cause this intermittent bout of depression to somebody who's prone to that pattern. So the recurrent brief depressive episodes can be a clue to underlying mechanisms. And then we have the premenstrual dysphoric disorder, PMDD. And this is a mood disorder characterized by emotional, cognitive, and physical symptoms during the luteal phase of the menstrual cycle. So the luteal phase of the menstrual cycle being the second half of the cycle after ovulation. Although many women may experience some changes in their menstrual cycle, for example, a little dip in mood around menstruation or some physical symptoms like breast tenderness, pain, and cramping, this discomfort or these changes are usually not excessive. So when someone is experiencing something like PMDD, these changes may be severe and really impair the person's ability to function. And this actually does impact about 5 to 8% of women, which I think is quite a lot. So here, the pathophysiology is increased sensitivity of the limbic system in the brain to the hormone fluctuations. So in a nutshell, when we're working with PMDD, if we can work to create better hormonal balance, then we have less fluctuations. And then even if the limbic system is still sensitive, it's going to be less reactive because there are less highs and lows happening in the body. And of course, we can work on other aspects of brain health as well. And then we have the seasonal affective disorder, or SAD. And this is a mood disorder where people have normal mental health throughout the year, and then they may exhibit depressive symptoms at the same time each year. Most commonly, this does happen in the winter, but it can also happen seasonally. Some people might get it in the autumn or the spring or the summer. It's just a marked pattern of a change in mental health with a change in seasons, hence the name seasonal affective disorder. And this is a type of major depressive disorder. So sometimes we do feel a little bit low in the winter. We get a little bit grumpy and fed up with the lack of light, especially here in the UK. SAD is really when someone is impacted to the point that it's really impacting their ability to function each day. And the pathophysiology here can be due to impaired pineal and limbic networks. So light exposure is going to be a really important thing for somebody with SAD. And one of the things I'll mention in this episode is the importance of circadian rhythms and light exposure. So if you are someone who's impacted by SAD, you want to be listening when I talk about that. So let's look then at the underlying causes of mood disorders. There may be many causes of low mood, and the biological imbalances that contribute to low energy, as I've said already, may overlap with the biological imbalances that create mood disorders. So we don't have to have a separate strategy for our fatigue and a separate strategy for our mood. The same strategy is probably going to be beneficial for both. When supporting low mood, however, we do want to consider two broad categories: psychological and physiological. So the main focus of this particular podcast is going to be on the physiological mechanisms and how we can support them. However, it's important to acknowledge the relationship between the two, and in some cases we can be impacted by both. I'm not going to talk about the nervous system today, just because in terms of this topic, it's easier just to separate out some of the information. But what I would say is when we're thinking about depression, we're also thinking about someone who's got a lot of dorsal tone, a lot of parasympathetic tone on in the dorsal vagal complex in their system. So somatically, we may need to work with that as well. But from a psychological perspective, we can experience various psychological mechanisms due to loneliness, maybe divorce or the ending of a relationship, financial stresses, relationship problems, loss of a loved one, loss of a pet, loss of your health, lack of self-worth, lack of purpose in life, which a lot of people have when they're ill, and unhappiness or guilt about life, decisions, and the way that things have turned out for you. So all of these are psychological in nature, but they will have a biological impact on your system. We cannot separate our physiology and psychology. They are intimately intertwined. And if we've got all of these things going on, that's going to create a chronic physiological stress response. And in turn, that physiological stress response is potentially going to be a driver for the physiological mechanisms which can contribute to low mood. And yes, then we can support with diet, lifestyle supplements, other things I'll talk about today. But the root cause is psychological. The root cause might be dealing with the relationship breakdown, dealing with the financial stress, dealing with the grief associated with the loss, dealing with the loneliness. And when those things are resolved, that's when people really do then start to see a change in their health, not just mood, but probably energy as well. So I've mentioned as I went through the different types of depression, I talked about the pathophysiology being linked with the networks of the prefrontal cortex and the limbic system, which are regions of the brain. And so in many cases, low mood or depression is a result of a decreased activation of these areas. And therefore, one of the ways we can support our mood is through stimulation of these areas and these specific regions of the brain. And so both the prefrontal cortex and the limbic system can be stimulated by food, physical exercise and movement, cognitive tasks and challenges, social relationships, social engagement, visualization, and music. All of these things activate neurotransmitters, growth factors, and opioids, which can improve mood, improve motivation, improve concentration, and improve overall happiness and passion. The catch, I'm sure if you're somebody who experiences chronic fatigue and you're listening to this, you're thinking, these are so many of the things that we take away when we have chronic fatigue. We might start to follow restrictive diets and food is just no longer pleasurable. We might limit our social interactions because socializing is exhausting. We might fear exercise or movement because it's a trigger for post-exertional malaise and we're trying to pace and not do too much. We might avoid cognitive stress or challenges for the same reasons. And for some people, they may have sound sensitivity, so even listening to some music could potentially be problematic for them. So we're kind of in this catch-22 where the things we need to do to stimulate those regions of the brain are things that overwhelm the body and feel too much. And so this is where we may have to work on stabilizing the body and improving brain health to a degree before we can begin to introduce some of these things. However, it's really important not to throw the baby out with the bathwater. So just because you can't go for a walk doesn't mean you can't do teeny, teeny, tiny amounts of movement at home. Or just because you're following a restrictive diet doesn't mean that you can't find ways to make it pleasurable. Or just because you can't meet a friend for a coffee doesn't mean that there aren't other ways that you can socially engage or socially interact. Or maybe because you can't read a full chapter of a book doesn't mean you can't read the first paragraph or the first page. So the magic is in the dosage, and even small amounts can provide the necessary amount of stimulation to build function over time. So don't underestimate the principle of titration. Do what you can and don't let what you can't do stop you from doing what you can, even if what you can do may feel pointless or significant it's one step on a whole staircase of steps to recovery and better health. The one thing worth just honing in on here is visualizations, because for the most part, this is something that people, even if they're bedbound, they can do. They can visualize. And this is one of the reasons why brain retraining programs can be really, really powerful for people who have chronic illness, is because they're stimulating the limbic and the prefrontal lobes of the brain. And that's something that's going to be really important in terms of building up the health of the brain again and supporting those mechanisms and supporting those systems which can enhance mood. So if you're looking for something like that to do, I personally did Annie Hopper's DNRS program. Obviously now have the Nurturing Resilience subscription, which is much more based on somatic work, but we do have some visualization exercises in there as well if you're looking for a more gentle approach to brain retraining, because the DNRS is quite like full on, so to speak. The other thing that I wanted to talk about is the duration of a mood disorder, because this can also give us a little bit of clues or some clues into what is going on. So the duration of the experience can help to identify the possible mechanisms for low mood and also the potential prognosis for improvement. For example, if someone has been experiencing a low mood for 6 months or less, there may be a better prognosis than someone who has been experiencing low mood as long as they can remember their entire life. So recent changes in mood may be associated with psychological stresses. Something big and stressful is happening in your life, which is temporary. There may be a temporary change in your mood, but it can also be associated with hormone imbalances. Now, as women start to approach perimenopause and then transition into menopause, that could be a potential reason for a change in mood. Circadian rhythm imbalances, as the seasons change and the amount of light changes, that could be something that impacts mood. Microbiome imbalances, like I mentioned, you know, acutely you could have a bout of food poisoning, and then after that, you just don't feel quite the same again. Or nutrient deficiencies or imbalances, difficulty sleeping, or even a sedentary lifestyle. You know, you get fatigue, and because you get fatigue, you become more sedentary, and because you're more sedentary, then your mood changes. When mood disorders are intermittent or relapsing, like the RBD, they can be associated with things like neuroinflammation, which I've spoken to already, autoimmunity, because as the body is experiencing flares, autoimmune flares, that's impacting mood, thyroid dysfunction, and also hormone imbalances again. And mood disorders that are chronic can often be a result of brain injury or neurodegeneration. Sometimes low mood that is chronic and ongoing can be an early warning sign for neurodegeneration and sometimes undiagnosed metabolic conditions. So the goal in functional medicine is to determine the underlying mechanisms which are contributing to the low mood, and they'll be different between different individuals, and then work towards addressing them. In cases where the underlying cause may be resistant to interventions, for example, someone has a brain injury, then the main goal might be to optimize their neurochemistry as much as possible and improve stress resilience as much as possible so that you reduce further damage, further decline, and overall stabilize and potentially improve quality of life. So that already feels like a lot, but what we're going to go into now is just the foundations. So we've obviously been talking about a lot of different conditions, a lot of different factors to consider, but irrespective of what someone's mood disorder may be, there are important foundations that may help to improve neurochemistry and stress resilience, which is essentially how we cope with stress. And these five pillars are physical exercise and cognitive activity. We've kind of touched on that already. Sleep and circadian rhythms. My favorite, blood glucose stability. Managing inflammation and oxidative stress. And then supporting the health of the gut and the microbiome. So you've probably heard me actually talk about all of these topics on the podcast before. So I do want to speak about them today, but I'm not going to go into each of them in loads and loads of detail. You can follow up on other episodes where I talk about these topics as well. So let's start with physical exercise. We know that this can be a double-edged sword when it comes to chronic fatigue due to post-exertional malaise and energy crashes. So the real thing here is we want to find the right dosage of movement that allows us to get the benefits of exercise. Because when we exercise, we increase our brain-derived neurotropic factor and opioids, which are mood enhancers. We can increase levels of important mood-enhancing neurotransmitters like dopamine, serotonin, epinephrine, and acetylcholine. We can optimize the activity of the limbic circuits of the brain, which we know is important now. We can increase blood flow to the brain, which is really important for supporting brain health, brain energy, managing neuroinflammation. We can support mitochondrial biogenesis. So we can support the building of new and healthy and functional mitochondria, which is going to help with energy production. So we want all of these benefits, but the catch is finding a way to be able to move so that we can have the benefits without falling into a pattern of post-exertional malaise or crashing. So it's really important to find some sort of way that we can move. And in some cases, it's not going to be appropriate. So we need to understand the nuance of the situation. But the general guidance that I've always felt is helpful is to do what you can do that allows you to feel recovered and then repeat the same next day. And this could be something as just some really gentle stretches in bed, some ankle movements, some wrist movements, a few gentle stretches, and that's it. That's all you can do. But what you can do is good enough. Or it might be going for a little walk, or for those people who have more capacity, it's Qigong or yoga, and then building up more intense movement as time goes on, because it is actually the intensity of the exercise that brings about more of the benefits. There's always going to be some trial and error. I have talked about exercise and movement on the podcast in previous episodes. I've interviewed Zoe from Actively Autoimmune, and she's got a great book on being able to exercise with autoimmunity, but it includes chronic fatigue as well. And then there are some people who coach individuals specifically on the movement piece of chronic fatigue. Julie Hunter is another one of those people. And I really want to get her on the podcast, but she is so busy and I am so busy. And between the two of us, there never seems like enough time, but it will probably happen eventually. So, you know, depending on where you are, you want to find a way to move. And if you feel very confused or overwhelmed about movement, working with a professional, even just reading Zoe's book would be a good place to start. Then the one that I really want to hit home is sleep and circadian rhythms. Sleep is when the brain regenerates. And when we don't sleep, our brain gets inflamed. And when our brain gets inflamed, our neurochemistry becomes unstable and we can experience changes in mood and overall changes in health. And it's not just about making sure that we sleep. We also need to sleep in a rhythm, which means we go to bed at the same time every day and we wake up at the same time every day. And we should ideally wake up feeling rested, but that can be work in progress. And what is really important is that individuals establish a healthy cortisol awakening response. In a healthy individual, cortisol is released in a rhythmic pattern. So cortisol being one of the body's stress hormones, and it should peak. The release of cortisol should peak an hour after waking, which is known as the cortisol awakening response. And then it should naturally decline across the day, reaching its lowest point at around 2 a.m. And research suggests that people with depression, including those with SAD, often experience altered cortisol secretions. And this may include either a blunted cortisol awakening response or a delayed cortisol awakening response, which can impact mood, but it can also impact energy and overall well-being. So in people with SAD specifically, the lack of sunlight during the winter can disturb the body's internal clock, affecting sleep patterns, affecting hormone production and other body functions as well. And then this disrupted circadian rhythm may alter the timing and the magnitude of the CAR, and this can be something which impacts mood. So cortisol awakening response, or CAR, is something that we can assess with a saliva test. A lot of my female clients might do the Dutch comprehensive hormone test, and that has a cortisol awakening response marker in there. Or some of my clients will just do an individual saliva test for cortisol awakening response. So if you've tested your cortisol awakening response and you know it's low, or you suspect that it's low even without testing, there are things that we can do to support it. And one of the things that I talk about the most with my clients is morning light exposure. And I will tell you now, every client who has done this has told me that it really makes a difference for them. And so what this is it's viewing bright light, ideally from the sunshine, within the first 30 to 60 minutes of waking. On a sunny day, you want to do that for 3 minutes, not through a window, not through glasses. On a cloudy day, 10 minutes, and then on a cloudy, very cloudy, rainy day, 20 to 30 minutes. So unfortunately, the worse the weather, the longer you have to be outside. I do have clients who it's just not within their capacity to actually get out of bed to go outside yet. And if that's the case, you can use a 10,000 lux light. And then hopefully over time, as your capacity improves, then actually get to go outside. If you can spend more time outside generally across the day, if you are someone who's impacted by SAD, that would be ideal. So the more daylight exposure we get, the more time we spend outside, that can be really, really supportive for healthy cortisol and healthy biorhythms. Other things you can do is you can take a cold shower or do a cold plunge within 30 to 60 minutes of waking. Not everyone is going to have the capacity to do that, but if you can, do. Or some high intensity exercise for 10 minutes after waking. Again, not accessible to most people with fatigue, but worth mentioning in case it is accessible to anyone. So we do have to be aware that, you know, some of these things are not going to be accessible, but if you can do the light exposure, that would probably be one of the best things you can do, especially if you are somebody who experiences SAD. The more time you can spend outside in nature during the day, in the winter months, and then when it comes to nighttime, if you can view the sunset, might be asking too much, but if you can view a sunset and then when you go inside, you can use your blue light blocking glasses, you can have the lights low and dim, no overhead lamps, no bright lights. That could be something that could be really supportive for your cortisol awakening response, for your circadian rhythms, but then for the knock-on effects that can have on your mood. So the next is blood glucose stability. If you have listened to many of my episodes, you will know that this is something I'm really passionate about because it's so important. And almost all of my clients have some form of blood glucose imbalance going on. And it's something that we work with all the time. And it is super, super important because stabilizing mood requires that we stabilize blood sugar. You can't get out of a mood disorder without stabilizing your blood sugar. And when blood sugar drops too low, there can be a surge of stress hormones, which impacts the brain. And when blood sugar is too high, this means that glucose isn't getting to the brain and you're not able to energize the brain. And that can impact brain health and brain function. So we need also to have proper insulin signaling to activate the synthesis of neurotransmitters. I actually have done another episode on neurotransmitters specifically, which you can listen to, where I talk about this in a little bit more detail. But surges in insulin are associated with poorly balanced blood sugar, and this can have a negative impact on things like dopamine, serotonin, GABA, and acetylcholine production, all of which will be important for mood and mood balance. So it's really important to say that people who have high blood sugar will also at times have low blood sugar, and people with low blood sugar will also at times have high blood sugar. And so therefore, the main goal is stability. I've mentioned this in many podcasts in the past. I've got blood sugar episodes for hypoglycemia and talking about carbohydrates and blood sugar monitoring. So you can go and listen to those. But ultimately, we want to stabilize our blood sugar to help to stabilize our mood. The next one of those five foundations is managing inflammation and reducing oxidative stress. So when we're talking about inflammation in the body, we're talking about a dysregulated immune response that comes from triggers like food, toxins, microbes, for example, infections, and trauma. And that could be obviously physical trauma, but it could also be emotional trauma as well. And so very simplistically, what this means is that we want to eat an anti-inflammatory diet. We want to reduce our toxin exposure and support the excretion of toxins from the body. We want to address infections in the body, and that might be things like SIBO or mold or candida or parasites or dysbiosis. There's obviously many different ways that we can experience infections in the body, even if it's on a low-grade level. And then we may need to work on stress and trauma and some of those psychological factors as well, because they can contribute to inflammation. So in terms of this topic of inflammation, every single thing I've mentioned here is potentially a whole podcast episode in itself. And some of these things I have covered already in individual episodes. But what I really want to hit home here is that the way that these things work is that if we can support systemic inflammation, we are essentially supporting neuroinflammation, brain inflammation. And brain inflammation is one of the causes of depression or mood disorders. When the system or the body is inflamed, it's very likely that the brain is going to have experienced some sort of inflammation as well. So as we reduce inflammation in the body, we reduce inflammation in the brain, and that means better functioning brain and better balance of neurochemistry. So definitely something to consider. And as I said, to talk about each of these things in this episode, I would be talking all day, but just to give an overview of thinking about how you can be supporting yourself through the lens of food, toxins, microbes, and trauma. And then finally, the last one is the health of the microbiome. Again, something I could do an entire episode on, but the gut is often referred to as the second brain. And many of our neurotransmitters are actually made in the gut. So we do need a healthy digestive system if we want to have good mood. And usually when we work on the digestive system, we use a north to south model. This is something that I go into in a lot more detail in my gut health mini course, which you can buy off my website. But then when I'm working one-on-one with clients, we're identifying, I guess, the weaknesses in that chain from north to south, and we're working on those in a case-specific manner. But very briefly, the things we want to do are supporting the nervous system and supporting proper vagal tone. We want to make sure that we're chewing adequately when we eat our meals. We want to make sure that we're producing enough stomach acid to digest and start to break down our food and maintain the pH of the gut lumen. We want to be producing good amounts of digestive enzymes to further support digestion. We want to deal with any infections in the gut, if that's small intestinal bacterial overgrowth or candida overgrowth or parasites or yeast or even just an overgrowth of commensal species, a dysbiosis. All of this needs to be dealt with for optimal digestive health. And we want to have a healthy gallbladder as well, which overlaps sometimes with the toxin elimination piece. So one of the most important factors to consider when mood is concerned is ensuring that there's a diversity of species in the gut. And this can be encouraged by eating a diverse diet, especially a diverse diet of different plants. And I think now with the popularity of the Zoe app and all of that, I think most people are kind of aware that we should be eating 20 to 30 different plants across the week. Plants can be tricky sometimes. People have digestive issues or problems processing fiber, and certain types of plants can be problematic. But for the most part, having a diversity of different plant-based fibers in your diet could be potentially something that's worth supporting as well. So these are the five foundations, just to recap on what they were. So we talked about physical exercise, we talked about sleep and circadian rhythms, we talked about blood sugar, we talked about managing inflammation, and we talked about supporting the gut. So addressing these five foundations can in some cases go a really long way to improving someone's health and someone's mood. However, there can still be some other underlying mechanisms that could be supportive as well. And just like the previous foundational five, you know, each of these different areas, which I'll mention now, are podcasts in their own right. And in fact, I think I've pretty much covered all of them in podcasts previously, but we want to consider addressing hormones. So sex hormones, thyroid hormones, adrenal hormones. And I do have podcast episodes on all of that. We want to address the thyroid, and I've done a podcast on thyroid health. We want to address neuroinflammation and brain health. I've kind of touched on that today because it is a really important part of balancing mood, but you can find more detailed information in previous episodes and my blog. We can address specific neurotransmitter imbalances. Often when people are trying to address mood, they want to go in straight away at the neurotransmitter level. But actually what we want to do is build these foundations and then address the neurotransmitters as the cherry on top. Because of, as I've explained already, is we need healthy blood sugar function for healthy neurotransmitter production. So if you're just taking individual amino acids or something like that, so for example, 5-HTP, 5-hydroxytryptophan to increase your serotonin production, but you have very bad blood sugar control, that 5-HTP may not necessarily be as effective. In some cases, it can actually make people feel worse. And that has happened to people that I've worked with in the past. And so then we also just want to make sure that we are addressing infections. That kind of overlaps with the managing inflammation piece. But if you haven't already covered that, perhaps you've just started to eat a very anti-inflammatory diet, then the next piece is to think about any toxins that could be activating the inflammation in the system. And we also want to be thinking about overall toxin exposure, whether that's chemicals, mycotoxins, heavy metals, or toxins from bacteria like LPS, for example, which I talk a bit more about in the endotoxemia episode. So hopefully you've learned something today, and hopefully that is enough to think about, enough to keep you busy, and hopefully help you feeling a little bit better and improve your mood. Obviously, managing a low mood condition and a low energy condition simultaneously can be quite challenging, mostly because the very nature of both leaves us feeling very low in energy and motivation to actually do anything about it. But the good news is that there is this overlap between things that are potentially causing low energy and things that are potentially causing low mood. So we don't need a separate strategy for each of these. The same strategy can be helpful for both. And my encouragement is just to take one small step forward at a time. It doesn't matter if your progress is slow. It doesn't matter if you can only do the teeniest, tiniest amount, but every step forwards is just one step up on that ladder on the way to better health. And to just really encourage you to just go slowly, do what's manageable, do what's achievable, and just keep moving, even if it's at a snail's pace. And obviously, health can be confusing and feel complex at times. That's why it's so helpful to have this framework of understanding the foundations, so we're not shooting in the dark. But if you do need more help and support, you can reach out. You can consider working with myself or one of the team members if you feel like you need a little bit more hand-holding through the process. So I hope you have enjoyed listening to this today, and I will see you in the next episode.